Hello and welcome to Dairy Pod. I'm John Penry from Dairy Australia. With Australian dairy farmers investing more than $100 million renovating pastures each year, assessing the performance or potential economic benefit of different ryegrass varieties is critical for farm profitability. In this episode, Gipps Dairy's lead REO, Matt Hall, and senior consultant in agribusiness at Pinion Advisory, Jason Lynch, talk about some of the practical ways to manage pastures, from what to consider when selecting a species, your sowing options, best practice pest and weed control, in addition to the value from using information available within the Forage Value Index.
I'm joined here by Jason Lynch, an agronomist from Pinion Advisory in Tasmania. Thanks for being here, Jason.
My pleasure, Matt.
Today we're going to have a discussion about, pastures and renovating pastures for dairy farmers and dairy farms, but I'm sure it could cross over into other industries, beef and the whatnot if it needed to. Jason, whereabouts in Tasmania are you actually situated?
I'm based in northwest Tasmania, and really northwest Tasmania is the principal dairy region, and that would probably be centred in the far northwest, around Smithton and the good country up there. High rainfall, pretty reliable country.
Okay. And are they all spring calving in that part of the world?
Yeah.
What's the system look like there for dairy farmers?
Pasture-based. Grain is part of the cow's diet. That's routine and normal. Quite traditional calving patterns. There are some autumn calvers, but very much in the minority. The feed base would be dominated by dryland pasture production systems, but it's pretty frequent to have most farms have one or two centre pivots, just depending on where they're located in terms of water resources, how much they've got. It is 1,000 millimetre rainfall, and it is pretty reliable in that they'll get typically a pretty wet winter and a wet spring. Summer can be a mixed bag. You can get quite green summers, and then autumn is pretty reliable in most years. You've got green grass again by and good growth rates by late March, early April.
Okay, so some really similar situation to South and West Gippsland or the Gippsland dairy industry by the sound of that.
Very, very similar weather patterns experienced, favoured by westerlies. Not a lot of easterlies get through to the far northwest though.
Okay, yeah, so South and West Gippsland, it's pretty similar.
Yep.
And strong pasture growth rates off May, June, July, peaking up in spring and then dying off in summer? Is that?
So definitely growth rates are really peaking in that October-November period, and it's not unusual to have under good conditions sort of that 70 to 80 kilos of dry matter a day. December, pastures are to a degree paying off, but it depends on the season conditions. By January in the far northwest, in most years, pasture growth rates are 20 to 30 kilos of dry matter a day. Late February, that'll be down to 10 to 20. But soon after, you get quite a quick change of season. So by April again, that could be 30 or 40 a day. And then progressively slow down into winter as the day length gets shorter. Pretty mild conditions. It's in this part of the state of Tasmania, you don't get hard frosts. It's overcast. It's short days. So let's say in June and July, growth rates 10 or 15 kilos of dry matter a day is pretty standard. If you're in the bottom of a valley, it can be less than that. I think the main issue that we get really in winter is quite wet soil. So waterlogging can be a really common feature, and pasture utilisation at that time of the year can be very challenging.
So it's actually very similar to Gippsland. We might just get slightly lower summertime growth rates and slightly higher wintertime growth rates in West and South Gippsland, but coastally it's probably quite similar. Mm. So given that, what are the most common issues that you see with pastures and where you're thinking about either a oversowing or a full renovation, I guess, to give it a bit of context? I'm wondering what's driving the need for those pastures to be re-sown, oversown or renovated?
Yeah, so I think the main thing we see with the turnover and renovation cycle with pastures, because it gets so wet in winter and flowing on into mid to late spring, physically paddocks get destroyed, for a better word. Pugging is quite a common feature, and it's just what happens in high rainfall areas. So whilst the individual grasses when you walk a pasture can be quite strong, due to pugging, we start getting gaps in and amongst it, and yeah, grass weeds, winter grass, broadleaf weeds start coming in. So pastures don't decline. You know, it's not one thing where, you know, in 1 year perennial ryegrasses, which are the dominant species, run out. You tend to see a weakening. It's not unusual for perennial ryegrass pastures now. If they mate 8 to 10 years, that would be good. That's probably balanced by the number of times they're in there, because they're so productive and they're using these pastures so frequently through the year. But law of averages would say that you will get waterlogged conditions. You will end up being forced somewhat to a degree to graze a paddock, whether it's spring, whether it's in winter or late autumn through to winter and into early spring, mid-spring, that, 2-3 significant soil waterlogging events can occur. Cumulatively over a number of years, we see that have problems. If we think about the methods that we generally employ, there's still an awful lot of forage crops and break crops growing in northwest Tasmania. So many, many producers would have a programmed approach where they would renovate, maybe up to 10% of their pastures. That'll vary. Some years it might be 5, some years it could be more. It's usual for many, many producers through that full renovation program to do a workup. They'll cultivate the ground, they'll grow a summer crop of turnips or forage rape, whatever the case may be. And then post that, they'll go back into a perennial phase. If the pasture damage is, let's say, superficial to a degree, where there's still reasonable integrity of the pasture sward, but you couldn't justify it from 1 year to the next, that is when they'll do an oversowing job, and they'll come in most commonly with Italian ryegrasses, but predominantly most people have a perennial base. So the Italian ryegrasses might be a stopgap for maybe a larger scale development where there might be drainage or something significant might be going on with some infrastructure, irrigation, new lanes, whatever the case may be. And that's probably the two options. Far more ground is probably oversown now than in the past, mainly because we've got better equipment. There's better drills available than what we were dealing with 15, 25 years ago. But in the main, complete renovation is probably the most common. Grass or grass forage crop grass.
Yep. And does that depend on what whether you're dealing with a root mat or whether you're dealing with a weed base or
if we're looking at the maximizing the success outcomes from oversowing, if you've got a root mat present, it gives very marginal results. It's quite hard to get consistent, reliable seed to soil contact. So if a root mat's present, that generally does end up meaning there's some aggressive tillage involved. I think the other thing that we really have to consider, we get quite a few slug issues, and cutting that drill through an established pasture creates a nice little highway for them. Or we get issues with lucerne flea. Red-legged earth mite's not particularly prevalent in northwest Tasmania. It can occur, but yeah, if we're not careful and not monitoring or you know, taking preventive controls, we can come up with some pretty bad results. Over the years, I've got to say that oversowing's been quite variable in the results, mainly due to a bit of those issues with either a combination of we had some root mat present, we had some slug issues, some lucerne flea, or we didn't have particularly good initial control over grasses. So we've drilled in there and, you know, under good conditions, you can very easily have a 40-day grazing round in, 35, 40 days in March and April. And that usually extends out until late May. So it can be quite hard for a new pasture to establish when there's quite aggressive growth going on there. But if it's done right, it can work well.
Mm. Yeah, it does sound pretty familiar to what we deal with on a, you know, year-in, year-out basis. So what about the actual date of when or the conditions, probably more than the date of when you're sowing it? What do you think are ideal conditions to renovate or oversow a pasture? And I'll, let me context it a little bit by asking about the risk management side of it. If you go early, it seems that if it survives, it's a fair advantage going in that you've got a more established pasture. And if you go late and the soils are cool, you know, it's that can be a bit of a challenge to growth. What do you think the balancing point is there and why?
That's a really good question, Matt. And my answer to that is, I think in northwest Tasmania, you really need to be ready and geared up in late February. You've got to have your seed ready, the contractor, the fertilizer, the visit by the agronomist to check and take care of any or know to start taking care of any pests that are there. It's quite common that in mid-March is about that sweet spot, thereabouts. In most years, we've already had some rain and you'll be drilling into a little bit of moisture. Alternatively, check the weather system and we've just got another westerly front coming through. And this autumn, I think, is a pretty good example that, you know, every 10 to 14 days, we're getting another westerly system coming in, often brings in 2 to 3 days of rain. Soil temperatures are still good, very rapid germination. Plants are out of the ground in sort of 4 to 5 days and it works well. I get very concerned the later we go, the more problems we can potentially have with slugs. They'll have hatched, away they go, lucerne flea, and, you know, they're fed buggers. They can really cause some problems, and unless you're on your hands and knees and monitoring, they get away. But fundamentally, the biggest problem I have with later sowings is reliably it gets wet in northwest Tasmania, as many sort of southeastern coastal areas, parts of Australia are. If those pastures establish well and they start getting quite long, all of a sudden we can be confronted with, let's say if we sow down in late April or early or mid-May, cooler soil temperatures, you might not be ready for first grazing for 80 or 90 days or something like that. That puts you right in the middle of, reliably when you're going to get quite a lot of soil water logging. And then you've got all this long, beautiful feed and you've got this terrible choice of, do I graze today and get all that great feed and probably pug my paddock because it's so waterlogged, a little bit soft through the cultivation, or do I let it wait until I've got a nice day? And I think the worst thing we can do for a new pasture, whether it's an Italian, an annual or a perennial, is that delayed first grazing, and these pastures end up, you know, getting 4,000 kilos of dry matter cover on there. That compromises tillering. If you mix clover in with it, it's pretty much gone. Shadowing effect. And, you know, I've seen numerous times where all of a sudden they can't graze their pastures almost until the following spring. So they're into it in September. So I think if people are organised and plan ahead, you know, Mother Nature plays a big role in this. You can only do what you can do. If you've got irrigation, it's much, much simpler and straightforward. But dry land sowing, sweet spot, 10th of March to the 30th of March. And I think thereafter we've got to recognise that if it all goes well, it works out. But it doesn't take much for a few good rainfall events into May, and all of a sudden, you know, soil moisture levels have built up and we get this horrible choice, which I'm sure everyone listening to this would have been exposed to over the years.
Yeah, I think that's pretty spot on, and I think that if you, you know, if the, as a manager of the land, if you make them, like, if you have a less than ideal sowing date in either direction, in my experience, the management decision down the track is harder. And yep. And so it actually it turns up the intensity of the result of what your decision is later on, and that can, you know, that will, in some instances, it can cause a failure of that new pasture after all the investment that you made. So you can do a lot of the stuff in preparation right, and then plant it late, and then have to graze it wet, or make the choice not to touch it until it's dry. And either way, it's not a great outcome.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge.
Yeah, at the end of the day, if you're going to go to the extent of spending this money, you need a reliable outcome every time you do it. We can't go in there and go, look, you know, we've got a chance that a quarter of the time it's not going to work. You can't do that.
Agreed.
And what I will say is, I think at the end of the day also, if, and for unforeseen circumstances, and this is just agriculture, if that sowing window does get pushed back further and further, but for all the reasons, you know, life, machinery, weather, we have to actually go, no, it's not right. We're not going to do it. And that can be tough to take. There can be people that have, you know, contractors and things like that. But if it's not right, then we don't do it. That's that, it, which is a tough call to make, but it's, you know, hindsight could be 20/20, or always is, I should say. But you have to do what you have to do at the end of the day.
So is there an opportunity to change the species when it gets delayed, to go, you know, to go from a perennial to an Italian, or even an annual based on how vigorous the seedling might be given the conditions, or the risk of pugging it?
Yeah, Matt, I think you're right there that if we're confronted with a choice of either having, for instance, you've sprayed out a paddock and you're doing a full renovation and then things just go awry, so then all of a sudden the perennial planting window disappears. You're spot on. We have to change that up. And we know that if we plant an Italian, they're more vigorous, they grow stronger in winter, and an Italian for that. Or it could be a forage cereal if it suits. As long as it's not going to get waterlogged. But, absolutely. And I think at the end of the day, if we go down that pathway, there are certain things that we know that we're going to have to do. If we put an Italian in, you know, all things being equal, depending on the rainfall and the conditions that we get in the following spring and summer. But for northwest Tasmania in high rainfall zones, you should get that 18 months to 2 years. If it's a hybrid, heck, you can get 3 to 4 years out of them. If you put an annual in, you know, invariably under most circumstances, by the end of December, they're about done. So then there's a turnover, and yes, you'll be repeating the process. But I think I'd take that over a potential failure of a perennial, just with the costs involved. Alternatively, you might be looking at doing an annual ryegrass and doing a repeat summer forage crop. So be it. But, you know, you take advice and think about the short term, the weeks and months ahead, but then think about, is it 9, 12 months, is it 2 or 3 years down the track that we're going to repeat this renovation cycle again? So be it.
Yeah, so that flexibility is something that's really a great thing to have, from what I've found anyway, and that ability to change the plan on the run a bit depending on what goes on with seasonal conditions or even how your timing was, whether or not you just didn't make it on time because other things popped up and you know, your farmer just didn't get there. What about some of the stuff around your varieties and heading dates, or, you know, looking at it and understanding what's good for a wet farm or what's good for a dry farm, and where do you see the advantages and disadvantages in that?
Yeah, look, I think in quite a lot of northwest Tasmania, there's quite a lot of rolling country. It's characterised by ridge lines and low rolling hills, not tremendously steep country. Those rolling topography will go off a bit earlier than the flat country. So I think if you've got elevation that typically is challenged for soil moisture past sort of that mid-late November, coxwoods can be ideal. And there's some fantastic leafy types of coxwoods now compared to probably some of the ones that we were dealing with, 15, 20 years ago. You might end up being in a position where you'll use more earlier and mid-flowering perennial ryegrass species, which are ideal. On lower-lying country, let's say if you're on ground that is particularly prone to waterlogging, my first question is, can we modify the environment? So there's an awful lot of hump and hollowing that happens in the swamp country in northwest Tasmania. I'm thinking, and people will be familiar with Tagari and Britain Swamp and Mellor and, you know, other areas around where fundamentally they're modifying the landscape significantly. Mm-hmm. If they're able to address that, then what we really want in that country is high performance, late flowering perennial ryegrasses. Usually that swamp country hangs well into summer. If we've addressed the waterlogging issue in winter, go and put something in there that's going to hang on and just grow like the clappers while that soil moisture is available. If you can't address that drainage, then we've got to make some serious choices. Is tall fescue something which is appropriate? It's interesting in Tasmania, they haven't really caught on. Why? Because when they really start to grow, we really struggle to keep them under control. And once they get a bit long and they start getting a bit rank and the cows are forced to eat them, there's a rebellion on your hands. It's not that tall fescue is a poor species. Far, far from it. Under the right conditions, it's exceptional. And I think if you're in an environment that gets a lot of heat, ryegrass may not be the best choice, then certainly tall fescue is going to be in there. But for northwest Tasmania, it's become a bit of a menace. But as I said, it's not the grass's fault. It's the management systems that we end up being exposed to, because, you know, those of you that know tall fescue, when it starts to grow in spring, it'll easily require rotation length down to, 16, 18, 20 days. Now, if the rest of your balance of your pasture sward is ryegrass and wants to be grazed every 25 to 30 days, it's very difficult to keep going back to that tall fescue. It's a management situation. Certainly in other dairying districts, let's say in the Midlands in Tasmania and maybe on the coastal areas of the northeast, tall fescues have got more of a position and they may be more suitable there.
So it's interesting. We've seen tall fescue used quite a bit in very wet paddocks, and the root thatch is actually really good defence against tugging. Mm. And those same paddocks do grow well in summer, of course, because they're low-lying and they hold moisture. So it's been successful in those areas. And our probably one of my observations about flowering date in ryegrass is that the later flowering ryegrasses on those wet paddocks, when it's a little bit more difficult to get there on time for silage making, really impacts NDF of silage, which has got a very big impact for intake in dairy cows. And intake equals milk production usually.
Yes.
So, you know, it's the flowering date in ryegrass in wet areas or on wet farms, and you described them well. Those, for us, that they're some of those areas around sort of Toora, Fish Creek, Leongatha South, Currumburra South, parts of Athlone and Boowong, and people listening to this will probably relate to some of that. And they're the areas that, you know, you just can't always get there on time to make your silage, and the impact is very big once you start feeding it.
Yeah. Look, Matt, I agree with everything you've said there, and I think that it's interesting. It can be, you know, within a property, within a district, what's good for you may not be suitable for someone else. And I think, you know, this is a lot of the planning consideration and talking to your neighbours. If you got access to a discussion group, there's nothing better than finding out what works in your area, because it's not a one-size-fits-all. It can't be like that, not these days.
Not if you're going to have really great management. I think it's you got to set up what you need for you as a farmer, and you know, and I think the right pasture variety or species to plant can be completely different within 5 kilometres. It just depends on whether you've got a red hill versus a grey flat soil in the bottom of an old swamp. And we get those variations.
Can I add to this? It's interesting. Some parts of Tasmania, let's talk the Derwent Valley, for instance. That is pretty much 100% irrigated pasture base. Harsh, cold winters, generally pretty good free-draining soils. Spring is fleeting, pivots get turned on. That is the perfect environment for late flowering perennial ryegrasses. It's the best environment. The warmth is there. It's a very reliable production system in the environment and the topography. There's not a lot of those areas, though, that have that very consistent. That is sort of a one-size-fits-all approach, but that's atypical for most areas.
Yeah. We've got a big variation over here in that we've got rain, you know, predominantly high rainfall, and an area of high rainfall, and then we've got an area of slightly lower and less reliable rainfall but still rain-fed, and then we've got a very reliable irrigation district in the MID, and that fits pretty well described it in your last little bit of discussion there. And then we've got another area further east, up in and around Orbost, and a shout out to those guys. They've got Kaikuyu based pastures on the hills, and their hills are hungry and hard, and they've got these flats on the edge of the Snowy River, and that's an amazing soil, and it can just hang on. You wouldn't have to put fertilizer on that. You could crop it every year for maize and still not need it.
They're lucky. They're blessed.
Service those guys well. I think that's pretty much. So we've got all of the scenarios in one right across Gippsland, which is pretty great, I think. Can you tell us about what you would do as a best practice for weed and pest control, just as a run up to planting a pasture, and then after it's struck and emerged and you're looking at it?
The range of weeds that we've got are somewhat quite straightforward. You know, we have, bear with me, I might not know the Latin names and I might be talking common names, but we've got the pink weeds. Sometimes we get a bit of cape weed. We'll get nightshade. wild radish, you know, these words would be common to pretty much anyone that'd be listening to this. You know what you're going to be going into, and knowing that a lot of these paddocks have had a history of forage crops, it could be dairy effluent being recycled, whatever the case is, we sort of don't know the weeds we've got until we create the conditions and they germinate. So if we're doing a full renovation, we want a clean slate to begin with. And then drilling the grass seed, you're looking closely to see what germinates in there. If we've got just pure ryegrass warts, so if it's annual or an Italian or just perennial ryegrass by itself, there's quite a lot of flexibility with the herbicides that we've got available, and you can get onto them fairly early, so they're not going to be a challenge to the establishing pastures. If we've got white clover, or we're going in there with things like chicory or, plantains and things, you've really got to watch your herbicide selections. Registrations will tell you what you can and can't do. But then over the top of that, you've got to look at the leaf stage of what these clovers and chicories are at. They do complicate things, but it's manageable. I mean, this isn't something new. There's plenty of good herbicides out there, plenty of good experienced agronomists, but we don't want to let these weeds get out of control. Does it affect the density of the new grasses and the clovers? So we monitor to manage. I know that gets used quite a lot out there, but we're watching for the weeds as they come up. Then we've got this choice. Do we spray before we graze or do we spray after we graze? I think that's a question for every single paddock that has to be assessed on its merits. We don't want to let the weeds get out of control and affect plant density numbers. If that's the case, you'll spray before you graze. But if we can get a grazing, open up that pasture sward, it'll promote tillering, the clover gets more light, happy days, and then we come in with a selective herbicide post-grazing, which would be great. I think that if we go back in time, we were talking about late sowings. I think the later we sow, the more difficult it gets to have machinery on paddocks. And so that's another issue that, you know, the later you sow, do we miss the boat entirely for weed control, which would be very disappointing because your contractor refused to get bogged in the paddock. I think for pests, look, invariably, slugs are a real problem in many areas of Tasmania, northwest not alone. It's almost standard practice for many producers to have to put bait as they sow. You've got to watch out for lucerne flea. And some areas of the state have to be really careful around red-legged earth mite. You've got no other option but to get down on your hands and knees and monitor. Occasionally you can see cutworm. That's not normal, but it's Mother Nature. Never say never. At the end of the day, if you're not sure yourself, then you just get your agronomist, get them in, get them to check. If there's economic damage, then you have no choice but to intervene. I think that, you know, they're pretty much the main things that we would deal with. The only other thing is occasionally we have some issues with birds and browsing wildlife. Not a lot you can do there if you're going to take to controlling them. You've got to know the species that you're dealing with because they might be a protected bird. And they're not fair game. And for browsing wildlife, at the end of the day, wallaby pre-fencing is standard in most areas of Tasmania. They will keep them out. Pretty hard to keep ducks out with a fence, though, but that's just...
Absolutely, yeah. And they can be an issue for us around dams and depending on the year. Interesting, you know, some of the things that I've found myself talking to farmers about over the years around, you know, pasture pests is, you know, as soon as you see it emerge, I just say to them every 4 days, go and have a look. Get down on your hands and knees, look for lucerne flea, look for red-legged earth mite. And when, you know, if you think the pests are winning the race, you know, in my mind, it's a race between the plant and the pest. And, you know, the plant for growth and the pest for eat rate. And if you think the pest is winning the race, it needs to be controlled. And, you know, because the advantage of controlling it's going to be greater than the cost of controlling the pest. So that's some of the things. So yeah. I just say every 4 days, head in there, have a look. Even though it's another job to do, I think if you've invested that much money in establishing a pasture, you know, it's well worth that extra effort and time.
The worst thing we can do is hope that it'll be okay and not look because we don't want to find what might be there, or not look because we didn't take time to do it. Like, it's the producers have just made a massive investment. These are things that you can control. You can't control the weather, but you can control what you see and what intervention you might have to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's spot on. So the forage value index, there might be some people listening to this that actually don't know what the forage value index is, and certainly how they might use it. And I just wondered, could you give us a quick rundown on what it is and how you use it?
So I'll start with, look, the forage value index, it's a great thing that's been developed and established and being maintained by Dairy Australia, allowing us to compare individual varieties. So it's not species, it's not Coxwood versus tall fescue versus perennial ryegrass. It's at this stage annual ryegrass, Italian ryegrass, and perennial ryegrasses. It's essentially merit-based testing. So series of independent trials, which are, you know, they're very, very rigorously managed. The data that generated and how that's interpreted is managed in a very strict framework. It's not an interpretation of the results. It's not subjective. It's done with a lot of rigor. It allows us to compare individual varieties one against the other. The measurements of the series of trial sites across southeastern Australia. You know, there's a number of sites in Tasmania, and they're looking at, I get this right, autumn, winter, early spring, late spring, and summer production. And from that, there's values put on the dry matter that's generated from it. The endophyte status of those species are listed in there, and the ploidy, is it a diploid, is it tetraploid, and something I'm particularly interested in is the heading dates. So for a producer to be able to go on there, and it's very easily accessible through the Dairy Australia website, typing in forage value index, you go on there and essentially without marketing, without any spin put on it, you are seeing varieties put head to head. I think the main thing is, though, that it's not so much let's compare and rank every variety as we go through, although that's how it's listed in there. You might need an early flowering variety, and you need to go down that list and pick out what is your best early flowering variety, or a mid-flowering or a late flowering. You might need to have a look at the endophyte status. These are the things that, you know, as a consultant and as producers, we need to be aware of when we're going to make that purchase decision. Does it suit our conditions? Is it the right variety for my production system? What you don't want to do is, you know, probably not be aware of some of the new developments that are happening. It's a really exciting time in the release of new varieties of annual Italian and perennial ryegrasses. There's a lot of new genetics coming out, and to have these varieties independently assessed and compared against, you know, some benchmark varieties which you know very, very well right now, how do they compare, and allowing us to essentially make nice, clean, independent decisions around that is invaluable.
So there's some really good potential there to line up your system and feed demand, and then the lay of the land, and looking at whether you've got dry hills or wet flats, and whether you calve early or date or early or late, sorry, and you know, where that fits, and then starting to look at some of those tonnages grown by season, so winter, spring, summer,
yeah,
and then starting to make some selections there, and even you know, looking at the endified as well, and then saying, rightio, this is what it's going to offer me, or the chances are that this particular variety is going to offer me something, and you'll know what that is, and it's assessed independently as well.
Yeah, Matt, we mentioned this before. There's a lot of things which are unpredictable in agriculture, the weather, the markets, and things like that. Selecting the right variety for your production system is something which is a controlled decision. You should be getting a reliable outcome. The seed that you're going to get is going to be reliably, you know, as what it is, you know, germination rates, et cetera, and the endophyte status. These are known outcomes, and being able to choose something which fits. I can give an example. If you had a dedicated area on your farm which you cut silage, and you typically, you know, hypothetically, you cut your silage in mid to late October every year. If you pick a very, very early flowering ryegrass variety, that may not be ideal for you. It'll throw its seed head up, your loose feed quality, as you mentioned earlier, the NDF goes up. You've just spent a lot of time and money and wrapping this up, and you're going to offer it to your cows a number of months later. You know, you're always going to, you've just, as we often say, it is what it is, but we selected something inappropriate. You'd be after something which is sort of in that mid-late date, still highly vegetative when you're going to be harvesting. And most importantly, after it's been cut, it'll bounce back. You know, and that's just
an example, isn't it?
Yep. It could be an irrigated production system. Mm-hmm. If you're under irrigation, you'll want generally very, very late flowering varieties which consistently hold that quality for as long as possible into summer. You know, don't set a lot of seed thereafter where that aftermath heading is kept low. That's another example. You just get reliable outcomes. And, you know, if we've got infrastructure or, you know, a certain reliance on a particular part of the production or the property, you do everything to get it year in, year out. It's highly repeatable.
I think the variety heading date and silage scenario really becomes evident when you start feeding it. And, you know, when I go through discussion group data and look at what cows can actually intake across groups, and some farmers can get cows to eat 7 kilos and other farmers have got cows eating 11 kilos. And NDF is what it boils down to. All cows are being offered everything they can eat. And that does make a big impact on milk production and margin.
Yeah. And,
yeah.
The information we've spoken about, that's consistent across all the annuals that are in there, the Italians that are in there, and the perennials. It's all laid out in the same way. Seasonal performance, total performance, endophyte status, ploidy and heading date. Talks about marketers in there, so you've got to know where you can get it from. But it's actually a very simple way to do it. It doesn't take, you don't have to read a whole lot of information beforehand. It's quite straightforward to interpret.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's fantastic. And so we've basically been through a fair bit of the discussion where that we've just looked at, you know, why would you oversow and renovate, and a bit about cropping and species and varieties and pests and weeds. Have you got any tips for our listeners about just about what are the best things that they can do once a new pasture appears? Like, what are some of the best things that they can do? So, you know, we've got a month's growth of a new variety out of the ground. We've spent all the money, and it's, you know, we planted it on the 15th of March. Now it's the 15th of April or the end of April, the start of May. When should we graze it and how, and what are the important things?
be very, very familiar with and understand the pluck test.
Yep.
So go out there with the grass, pretend your hands are the lips and the teeth of the cow, grasp the leaves, shear. If the roots don't come up and the leaves easily break off from the plant, it's ready to go. The earlier we can get that first grazing on for all of these grasses, the more tillering you get. The more tillers you get, the greater the pasture density. That's what we want. We want a thick, dense pasture. For perennial species that have got mixed, well, it could be an Italian that's been mixed with white clover or red clover or a herb. When those pastures are ready and pass the pluck test, they need to be grazed, because otherwise you compromise the clover's growth and the stoloniferous habit of it literally within weeks. And we throw stones at the clover saying they're not as good, the coatings are no good. If they don't get sunlight onto that stolon, you know, consistently, they just disappear. They cannot persist. And we've just gone and spent quite a lot of money. We've gone and sown them at whatever, 2, 3, 4, 5 kilos, whatever it is. And we wonder why they're not there. Mm. And we say it's this, it's that, it's the clover, it's the nitrogen, it's the management of it at the end of the day. So if the take-home thing, and if I've just got one thing, would be being able to be knowledge about the pluck test, whether you do it, your children do it, your agronomist does it, your trusted advisor, do that and send the animals in. Being able to get a grazing on a new pasture before winter sets in is gold. It sets up a perennial pasture for years and years and years to come. Firm up the seedbed before it gets too wet. These are little things that all add up to, you know, allow us to utilize a lot more pasture and get, you know, consistent, reliable outcomes. And the only other thing I'd say is just monitor and keep an eye on for pasture and weed pests. These things don't generally creep up on you. It's not like they weren't there yesterday and you've come out this afternoon and gone, yep, they weren't there before. No, they were, but you weren't looking for them. Maybe crickets are a little bit like that, where they'll come out of the ground, but, you know, you'll hear those ones. But, you know, you just got to keep an eye on things, because we just don't want a simple error like that to cause a failure. That's something which could be prevented.
Okay, thank you. And just a quick touch on fertilizer. With a new pasture, so we've grazed our new pasture for the first time. What would be a decision making process around whether or not you just go with a nitrogen supplement, or whether you go with a NPKS supplement or another approach? What would be the things that determine in your mind which way is the best way to go?
So I think of nitrogen just as another boarding supplementary feed. So I'll turn it on and off as needed to feed the cows. Now, mercifully, nitrogen fertiliser prices have dropped down, and it's back in the realm of being quite profitable use again, and we're rejoicing about that. So I think follow-up nitrogen would be appropriate if, one, we need to push feed into the system. And I think that if you're running annuals or Italians where they're here for a short time, not a long time, or a good time, not a long time, you may very well need to push the system. If you were coming out of, for instance, a system where you had a big root mat and you had to cultivate it up and you had an awful lot of organic material in there, all that root mat will draw nitrogen down in, and it'll rob that from the availability of the plant itself. If that's the case, you will need to put nitrogen on, not just to grow food, but actually to satisfy the plant's requirements. We know that if a pasture is deficient in nitrogen, you tend to get less tillering. And so you know, you've got to address that. If the choice then becomes, do we put something else in there? We've got to be particularly careful in Tasmania with soil water logging. And there's a bit of a loose rule of thumb that once we start sort of heading into May, you probably should avoid putting too much phosphorus and potassium on, particularly wet conditions with those nutrients going around. You know, if you're on a swamp soil, that can be quite difficult to realise a good outcome for it. I think, you know, hopefully going right back before we started this, we would have done a soil test. Yep. That's probably the beginning. And at the time of sowing, whether it's DAP, which is the most common go-to product, or whether it's single super and, you know, with all that muriate of potash or sulfate of potash, whatever's required, address that there. Generally, therefore, we're saying the next time after sowing, we would generally go in with phosphorus and potassium and sulfur would be in spring and follow up like that. But everyone's going to be different. I mean, you can be in some quite dry perch country, and I don't really have a problem with phosphorus going on. You'll get good efficiency and good reliability. So that rule I mentioned, that's for low-lying and sort of high rainfall country in Tasmania. I mean, there's a lot of other different products out there that you can put on your pastures. All I'll say is make sure they work. Make sure that you get a consistent and a reliable outcome from it. Probably don't use gibberellic acid in the first year. You probably shouldn't use that. It's pretty popular to use, but I think, you know, the evidence tells us that in the first year of a pasture, particularly a perennial, it's a bit of a no-no. Apart from that, pH, but generally, look, you know, if you've got access to lime sand or a quick-acting lime material, you'll get a good result quite quickly. But generally, pH management, it's a long-term management strategy. But definitely, if you started in particularly low numbers, like if you're in the low ends of fours, you know, we could talk about this for quite some time, should you be putting a perennial in? Because it takes a long time to change pH. We're not talking weeks. You're generally talking months, and if you're at the low end of five, yeah, well, this is where annuals and Italians probably have a perfect fit, because, you know, they're a little bit more tolerant of slightly more hostile growing conditions then.
Okay, yeah, and certainly, yeah, we see a bit of that, and maybe it's a great topic for another day about soil acidity and nutrient availability. And you know, how that might also, high aluminium levels and iron levels might impact phosphorus availability and root development and some of the stuff that commonly actually kills ryegrass.
Absolutely.
Yeah, maybe that's a great topic for another day. Well, thank you very much for your time, Jason. I really appreciate it, and I've really enjoyed having this discussion with you. I think one day the opportunity might come to get you over to Gippsland and get you talking to some farmers would be fantastic. So maybe one day we might be able to make that happen for some of our local farmers.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dairy Australia, for giving the opportunity. Matt, thanks very much for interviewing me. And look, I get rather excited over grasses, and I reckon we're in a very, very interesting time in the next 3 to 5 years. Watch your FBI tables, because you're going to see some pretty interesting stuff coming out soon.
Thank you. Yep, I'm looking forward to that. Thanks very much again.
If you would like to find out more about the Forage Value Index and are looking for the most profitable ryegrass selections for your farm, you can find the new and expanded 2023 tables at www.dairyaustralia.com.au/FBI. We've also placed the link in the episode notes. We hope that you have enjoyed this Dairy Pod episode, and if you have any questions about the podcast or have suggestions or ideas for future episodes, you can get in touch with us by emailing dairypod dairyaustralia.com.au. Thanks very much for listening, and bye for now.